Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi everyone, I'm Chris Tanya, amateur chef by day and professional Netflix viewer by night.
And hello from me, camp enough for your mum to like, but butch enough for your dad not to get uncomfortable. But just call me Alexis for short.
Welcome back to another episode of Community.
On this episode, we'll be discussing our LGBT future with audio from the last of our live panel discussions.
In the last couple of years, it seems that LGBTQ rights have been on the rise, and we are becoming more integrated into mainstream society. Well, for those of us that live in the Western world. But with the rise of the far right and Brexit, things don't seem to be as certain as they once were.
We don't have a crystal ball. And so to ask what's in our future, we turn to the panel. We were joined on the panel by Susie Green, CEO of Mermaids, a specialist charity that advocates for and helps look out for young trans people. Lee Fontaine from the Albert Kennedy Trust. The Albert Kennedy Trust work with 16 to 25-year-olds who are homeless, faced with homelessness, or living in a hostile environment. And just a quick side note, Mermaids and the Albert Kennedy Trust are the two charities that we at Community pledge to support and platform boost. We aren't making any money from this podcast. This is a bootstring self-funded production. But if we're ever fortunate enough to get any money in, profits will help go to these two charities, our way of giving back.
The final two panellists are Tanya Compass, who is an award-winning youth worker, writer, speaker and mentor, along with working on youth engagement at UK Black Pride. Charlie Kondu, actor, patron and ambassador for numerous LGBTQ charities and gay dad of two. Also, if you're a Coronation Street fan, you might recognise his voice. As we're 51 years on from the partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, we ask the panel what we want LGBTQ people to achieve in the next 51 years. Susie kicked off the conversation.
I would like Mermaids not to have to be here at all. I would like transgender children and young people to not be considered other. And I would like to see a world where everybody is kind to one another. And there doesn't need to be a helpline or an email service or any kind of support around it, because it's just part of being human. That's what I would like to see.
This is Lee.
I'm going to second what Susie says. We say at AKT that we're working to make ourselves obsolete. So in 51 years, I'd like to see a world where LGBTQ youth homelessness isn't overrepresented in youth homelessness sector.
When Lee talks about overrepresentation in youth homelessness, it's a real challenge. Best guesses are that we LGBTQ folk make up about 1 in 10 of the general population. And yet, nearly 1 in 4 homeless people under the age of 25 identify as LGBTQ. In adult men, the leading cause of homelessness is mental health issues. For adult women, it's leaving an abusive partner. And for young people, it's being LGBTQ.
Next, we're going to hear from Charlie.
Without getting too political about it, it was the partial decriminalisation. And yes, it was fantastic, but actually, we had a very long way to go. Up until very recently, I think it was around 2006, where the age of consent was equalised. And in fact, there were a lot of things that happened soon after the partial decriminalisation, which is if you were found having sex that wasn't in your own home with the curtains drawn and nobody else in the house, you could go to prison. And the sentences for that were in fact made longer after 1967. So in fact, there were a lot of things that got worse quite quickly after that. Having said that, we've come a long way, obviously. And I think I'd sort of agree with everyone. We want to get to a point that I think it's quite clear that we're not at, where we have full equality, which we simply don't have at the moment. And it's lovely that we have equal marriage and like normal people, and we can have kids like normal people and all of that kind of stuff. But I think we've still got a long way to go, really.
And lastly, Tanya gives her perspective.
I'd like there to be that LGBTQ plus community isn't just a tick box. I feel like so many times it's like you only see representation because they have to tick a box. I think it should be a natural thing. Like, I think the lack of representation, especially that from the Black and POC community within the LGBTQ plus community, is so small and it's so lacking. Like, they tick one box, they might have like one gay white man there and they say, oh, everyone suddenly now sees themselves, but it's not true. We don't. So I think to be able to have that natural thing, as you quite rightly said, where everyone, we just exist as ourselves, whether that's queer, whether you're straight, whether you're black or brown or blue, whatever you may be, like, it don't matter, but you can be yourself and young people can see themselves in us and not have to search for it because it's just there.
I feel like the panel started off really strong. Lee and Susie were absolutely right. Hopefully in 51 years, we won't need mermaids because trans children and young people will get the support they need and be treated just like cis children. Homeless LGBTQ youth have been overrepresented in homelessness for a long time, and it would be great if we could put an end to it. Personally, I think that in the next 50 years, I would want trans people to have the rights that they deserve, especially because we owe so much to them in the fight for LGBTQ rights.
We then asked the panel if they think that they would always be in need for LGBTQ spaces.
It feels to me like we're hopefully moving away from all of that stuff and looking at, and certainly some of the work that mermaids are doing, and looking at gender as a whole and people more and more seeing that they fit somewhere on a scale and being non-binary. And it feels in a lot of ways that we're moving away from ticking those boxes, or in fact being in those boxes, I would hope. And so I wonder if that's where we should be aiming, so that we eventually get seen as people and not other, as we have been for such a long time. So that would be my kind of hope, really.
What I think Charlie is saying is that he hopes that all of us in the LGBTQ spectrum can stop being seen as other, that heterosexuality and cisgender are immediately assumed, and that will stop. It's a nice sentiment, but given that mathematically, the reality is that we are in the minority, I think it would take a very long time and relies on the wider world being less binary about gender and sexuality and seeing both as a spectrum. However, attitudinal surveys hint that this might be happening. Research by Ipsos Mori found that only 2/3, 66% of young people aged between 16 and 22 identify as exclusively heterosexual, the lowest figure of any generation ever. For context, millennials are 71% exclusively heterosexual, which is in itself is a big drop from the 85% of Gen X and 88% of baby boomers. But as we've yet to see what impact this has on long-term LGBTQ spaces, we'll return to that conversation as Susie goes on to speak about the fellowship young people and parents experience at Mermaids.
I think one of the major things that comes from parents and young people coming to Mermaids is that sense of community, because being trans is very much, as you know, within all of the intersectionalities, is massively isolating, and being on your own against a tide of people telling you that either you are wrong, or if you are a parent supporting a trans child, that you're doing something wrong by supporting them. We present and give people that sense of community. And right now, that sense of community is really massively important, because otherwise people are alone. And when you are alone, that's why our stats in terms of our young people are so poor in terms of self-harm and suicide. And we need to address that. And that needs to be done by extending that community to include everybody. And I do think that as time goes on, then we will include everybody. But we ran a trans prom at the end of June in this year, and we had 50 young people who many couldn't attend their own discos or proms because they felt too other, or they'd been ridiculed and bullied, or they just couldn't go because they were too anxious to attend and to be made to feel so different. And at the end of that, a couple of the young trans guys came up to me and they said they got hot. And at the end of the night, they took their shirts off and danced in their binders because they could, because that was a safe space for them to do so. So until society as a whole doesn't bat an eyelid at young people presenting themselves and letting go and being able to be themselves, yeah, we need safe spaces.
In a utopia, I would hope that we wouldn't have to tick boxes. But I think that, like, if we, like, look back and we all sit in this room and we say that we've come a long way in 51 years, but we haven't actually come a long way. And I don't think that the needs of the LGBTQ community and their experiences are directly correlated when we gain civil rights. Because what we're thinking is that, yeah, rights for, like, gay white men has, like, catapulted forward, but we leave our trans brothers and sisters and those that don't want to identify within the binary and those that identify from black and ethnic minorities behind. And so when I think about, like, what's the future going to be, one day I have to think, like, what are my rights going to be as a person that identifies as queer? And then I have to think, what are my rights going to be as a person of colour? And safe spaces, or identifying areas where I can go and I can be around other people of colour, or I can go and experience other people that identify as LGBTQ plus, is important for me. And the real importance is because of the escape from microaggressions. Because we can label that, you know, that we can get married and that we can have children and all of these things that come along with civil rights. But civil rights and the perceptions of society, they're always at, like, two completely different levels. And what that means is those that are in the minority margins are usually the ones that have to deal with not always overt racism, although, like, we are dealing with overt racism today. We're still dealing with, like, overt homophobia, transphobia, biphobia. But it's like those tiny little micro aggressions that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis as a minority. And I haven't seen those dissipate much over the last 32 years of my young existence. And I'm hopeful that they will, but I don't see it happening anytime soon.
They'll always forever have to exist, but just need more funding and need more support. Black Pride, I would hope that there's never going to become a day where Black Pride is not going to be a thing. I just hope that Black Pride is going to get bigger and better, because you see what happened at Pride this year when you've got, like, transphobes that are leading a march and then Pride in London are not doing anything to stop that. Whereas, so I didn't even go to it. Like, Black Pride for me is my only Pride, the only Pride that I recognise. And I'm not just saying that because I work there. That genuinely is, because that's the only time, that place that I actually see myself seen and represented in the most natural and authentic manner. And I think that we need to give, like, more of a platform, and people in the community need to recognize the privilege and be like, okay, cool. Sometimes, like, spaces are not for you, and that's okay. So if you are going to, like, a black queer space and you're going by yourself as a white gay man without any black queer friends inviting you, stay at home. Not that we're never gonna get to a space where it doesn't matter, but I think they should always matter. Like, our intersection of, like, our identity shouldn't be something that we should, like, ignore. It should be something we celebrated. Our differences are something to be celebrated. And just because we're different doesn't mean you can't, like, obviously sit on a panel and get on, but just accept it, accept that you're different, accept your privilege. And then from that point, allow these people to have these spaces and allow and support them, whether it's through putting money into it, whether it is through supporting it, through spreading it through word of mouth. So maybe if you work with a queer black young person, or if you work with somebody from a certain community, they can also see it. Put your money where your mouth is. Put your time where your mouth is.
We would love to live in a world where safe spaces weren't necessary, but we don't live in that world, and I don't think we will for a very long time. And until that time, I think that's absolutely it. We need to accept our privileges and understand that there are other people that don't have that and that need those spaces, actually need them.
Personally, amongst all the discussion about the safety of queer spaces, for me, now that I feel safe and secure in my identity, I still want these spaces. I'm always going to want gay and queer clubs to go to, because, yeah, safety and pulling aside, Jesus, straight clubs are boring.
As nobody quite had an answer about the future of queer spaces, Alexis interviewed Johnny Wu, drag queen and owner of the Glory Pub in East London. He shared his opinion with us regarding LGBTQ plus spaces. He starts off by talking about his observations of East London, a queer creative part of the city.
When I moved in 95, there were tons of gay venues around here. There were loads, there were at least 10. And they all closed in quick succession over the next couple of years. So this conversation about losing LGBT spaces isn't a new story. It's old. You know, it happens. And I don't know, I think maybe particularly with queer spaces, I think they, I don't know why they kind of, maybe it's because they immediately impact on our community. If you look around, pubs and bars close all the time. They're always closing. There's loads of bars and pubs have opened. You know, they've opened, they close. They fail. If there were gay spaces, queer spaces, we'd be, oh no, we've lost another LGBT venue. I think this conversation about losing spaces and the reason why we're losing spaces has got a little bit lost. I think the reasons why spaces close varies. It's not the same story with every single space. And if you actually knew the information as to why these places were opening and closing, I think the conversation would be different. And gentrification, if anything, is the reason why there were gay places around here anyway. There were kind of a whole load of black venues in this area. They closed down. So there's a different community which suffered as a result of, you know, a more kind of white economic community moving in. It's a little bit part of city life. It's up to people to kind of open, you know, open places. You know, bars, businesses aren't charities. And actually the reality is we don't need so many specifically queer spaces. Now, we don't need so many, because you can just go to the pub and you know you're not going to get beaten up, you know you're going to get fucked over. Most of my stuff wasn't done in gay bars. Like, this is the gayest I've been, having the glory. Before that, with Bistro Tech, Soho Theatre, does tons of queer stuff, doing stuff at the ICA. I think maybe I was just one of those people, and there's a lot of these people like me about, who will hunt out spaces to kind of do stuff.
It's good context to think about. How many of us actually go and support gay-owned businesses and spaces? We moan when they close, but are we doing our own part to help keep them open? This aside, he makes a very good and valid point that closures and change of location and space has always been a constant part in the story of LGBTQ spaces.
Let's switch back. The panelists touched on the need for safe spaces.
I think there are places like the AKT provide, the houses that AKT provide, and living with mentors and whatever, where they actually have to go there because they are being beaten or worse. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of the young people at AKT, and some of their stories are unbelievable. And the other is what you were talking about before, Tanya, about being able to go somewhere where you can simply just exist as yourself and not have to think about what anybody else is thinking about you, not worry about perceptions, just know that you are with people that are like you. You can see yourself represented, and that is enough. Just because so many times as minority groups, I'm sure all of us in this room have felt that at some point, that we don't quite fit in certain situations. And that can be exhausting.
Like, Black Pride, whilst it is for everybody, it's also not everyone can actually physically access that place, whether it is because they've got social anxiety, there's a myriad of reasons why maybe Black Pride, they don't feel they can access that space. And that's why you've got things like AZMag, who creates like a platform where people can access it, no matter if you're at home, no matter if you're in another country, but you can see yourself represented as a Black queer person or POC person from the LGBTQ+ community. Like, I think that every space that's created, whether it's physical, whether it's online, as long as you can see yourself, it's a celebration. I don't think we should like kind of stick it solely to like, you have to be in that physical space, because I think that also can lead to like feelings of isolation, because you feel like, oh, if I'm not actually there, then am I really part of this community? That's why I think that I'm always pushing for more people to create and start events, start organizations, start spaces, because some people may like to go and, like, I love to rave, like I'll go raving, I love that. But some people actually might like to sit down and do life drawing. I do both, but like, but it's important to have so many spaces. I don't think we should ever, there will never be a space where there's only going to be one specific thing, but just celebrate the fact that, like, yo, the more the better.
I think I see as well, young people sometimes who come to us who are too anxious to access spaces. So too anxious to come to residential weekends, too anxious to come along to prides, too anxious maybe to sort of take part in stuff because they feel too other. And then it's about giving them the confidence that they're not alone, that there are lots of other people who feel the same way, that they're part of a community. And then they can celebrate. They then can come along to the events such as Pride and turn up there and be strong and stand there and be proud of themselves and who they are and what they've achieved. But sometimes that's a long road, for especially if somebody has been subjected to a household where they're not allowed to be themselves. And that applies to the whole of the LGBTQ community. So sometimes it's around helping somebody to reach that point where they can celebrate.
I think that there are never going to be enough venues for LGBTQ people, whether that's online or in real life. There is something out there for everyone. And as time goes on, venues will evolve and grow into whatever is needed to better serve the community, especially young people. Tani gives her perspective on what she hopes for the future of the young people she works with.
So I used to work for a charity, a sports for development charity, not just working with LGBTQ+ young people, like all young people in general, but it was really interesting that, like, I'm a black queer woman. I go enter a space and I'm always going to be a black queer woman. Therefore, when I recruit young people for a program, I'm not there saying like, hey, come and join me, I'm gay. But it's more so like, come and join. It's actually surprising how many young people join the program that may not have realized they were queer beforehand, but then realized maybe halfway through it. Like, I made a point of making sure that whoever I brought in to run workshops were people like babes, were people from the LGBTQ plus community, because like, I only came out when I'm 26 now. I came out at 24, and it wasn't even, I don't even say coming out. It's more so I came to understand my sexuality at 24, because prior to that point, I'd never known that the black LGBTQ plus community existed. So it's like, my thing is that, yo, if I can create that representation for them naturally, I'm not forcing it down their throats. They just happen, these are the people that they're not leading a workshop always around gender or sexuality or identity. They may just be coming there to teach a dance class, they may just be coming there to teach like creative writing or whatever it may be, but they just so happen to be queer, and it allows the young people, straight, queer, whatever, and they, however they identify, to know. Equally, to those that may be queer, to know my identity is okay, but equally those who are not, to know how to be allies. And I think that's also a really, really important space. I think that the services are failing young people completely. It's really shocking to hear some of the stories I hear about young people in care. Like, I work with one girl that from my previous job that I see her every week still. And some of the shit she's had to go through as a young person in care, she's been put in houses of homophobic parents, getting beaten and shit. And like, that is a reality. You go into schools and teachers are purposely misgendering students because they don't agree with it. And these are things that you see every single day, and nobody pulls them up on it. There's teachers that are hearing homophobic and transphobic language in a classroom and just let it happen. Like, it happens all the time. And it's really interesting because as young people, like, unfortunately, like transphobic and homophobic language is intrinsically part of slang. Like, I grew up using that same language and I had to unlearn it. But the thing is that you have to want to unlearn it, and you have to want to show those, like, not in a way like, oh, you're wrong, you're a bad person for saying that, because some of them genuinely don't know that what they say is wrong. Like, the word gay used to be something, if someone was annoying, oh, that's so gay. I remember when I got called out for it at 21, I was like, I'm not being homophobic, like, it's just what I say. And then I had to accept that in myself and be like, yeah, that's actually language that I have to unlearn. And teachers don't want to unlearn it, the services don't want to unlearn it, they don't know how to support trans young people, they don't understand how to support non-binary people. And I think that the more layers there are to your identity, the harder it is actually to seek and access the help that you need. And that's why you have like places like Mermaid, AKT, Project Indigo. There's so many organizations that do specifically work with young people from these minority groups. However, not a lot of them know that they exist because teachers don't want to tell them they exist. The services don't want to tell them they exist because they don't want to have that uncomfortable conversation. Like, the amount of homophobic youth workers that are out there is actually ridiculous. There's so much that needs to be done. And that's why I think there's so much more emphasis on social media and the media, so young people can realize and access this information. If they're not hearing it from their teachers, they can go online and see that there's people, whether it's YouTubers, like, everyone talks shit about YouTubers, but like, young people really see themselves in it. They really find a community on social media of people they may never meet face to face. Making sure you work with like prominent influencers, however you call it, so these young people can access and find out, okay, cool, I can actually go to Mermaid because I feel like that's where I can see myself represented. I can send my parents there because they don't understand my identity. And I think that I found out about Mermaids last, like, when I first started working with Black Pride, and since then I've actually passed the services on to teachers because I'm like, yo, you're using wrong language, like, I think you should read this. And it's about knowing, and once you know it, you pass on that knowledge.
I would like to see this in education from primary school upwards. I would like to see a broad diversity across the materials that are being used. I think that it's very masculine in terms of, you look at a load of bookshelves and like 90% of the books are about male role models. And I think that we need to be taught from a very young age that actually difference is okay, and that everybody is different, and to learn to be kind towards one another and accept people for who they are. One of the things that we see constantly, because we've got Department of Education money and we deliver training into schools around homophobia, biphobia and transphobia, is that teachers feel really ill-equipped to deal with this. They may have the will, but they don't have the knowledge. And that's because actually our services in terms of government-led services are so poor. And there is nothing out there to tell teachers how to deal appropriately with LGBTQ young people. And therefore, they're floundering.
Education is key. The majority of us, we grew up in a time when LGBTQ identities weren't discussed in schools, or at least, certainly not in positive ways. While religious education classes in schools are designed to promote understanding and tolerance of different faiths, we're rarely afforded similar treatment. If we leave aside the validation and visibility that education representation of queer history and positive role models in school would provide, and just focus on the mechanics of same-sex attraction and the trans experience, proper education on gender, relationships, emotions, and the practicality of sex could do so much to lift shame, stigma, the sense of confusion that many young LGBTQ people feel. Not only this, but it would educate and enlighten cisgendered and heterosexual young people too, helping to make the queer experience less other, creating a more accepting and aware generation.
While the national curriculum in schools hasn't caught up, media portrayal is starting to do this work. Led with YouTubers, internet personalities, young queer and trans actors and writers coming out. And even the traditional are starting to give young people education and visibility we've never had before. Susie picks up on this.
So then they rely on their own senses of what is right and wrong. And unfortunately, what you see in the media is often a parody of what people are actually like. One of the things that is coming out is an ITV drama called Butterfly. So it's three parts. It's Anna Friel, who plays the mum, Emmett Scanlon plays the dad. And this is a drama, so it doesn't actually mean putting real people up there and exposing them. But it's a drama about a trans girl and the family division around that. And it takes sort of over, I'd say, 3 weeks. And that's the first bit of drama that's dealt with this in a responsible manner. And I can't bloody wait.
I guess services like AKT exist because generic services are failing our community. We were set up 30 years ago, well, 30 years next year, because the care system in Manchester were letting young LGBTQ young people down. And unfortunately, 29 years later, I'm still seeing social services and the care system let young LGBTQ young people let us down. AKT has something called supported lodgings, which is basically where we train volunteers in the community that own their own home and have a spare room to be able to take in a young person. And some of that is then spot commissioned to local authorities. So when someone is a looked after child under Section 20, they're able to come to us and ask if they can pay to put a young person in our care. Currently, we're the only LGBTQ specific service that offers LGBTQ plus hosts in that kind of environment. And social services still don't get that sometimes young LGBTQ plus people want to be around older LGBTQ people that they see themselves reflected in. And constantly, obviously, I run London service, but I also do a lot of the casework as well. And what I still see a lot of the time is that the wrong language is used, but also because we have a Tory government, so there is a lack of funding for statutory services. And each year, I've been working in this sector now for 7 years, and each year I see services closed down. I see local authorities receive less funding. I see where pots of money were going to charities disappear. And it's a really, really dire. So I understand that statutory services are literally like bursting at the seams and that they're under a lot of pressure. But we had a young person that approached social services a couple of months ago, and the young person was in a hostile environment. There was psychological and emotional abuse, and they'd got themselves to the point that they could approach social services. They're the people that you're supposed to approach when you're in that situation. And the response of the social worker was to go back in the closet until you're 18. I'm just going to let that sink in. I wish that was an isolated experience, but it's not an isolated experience. And actually, when we do our impact reports each year, the number, so last year it was 77%, this year 78% of our young people cite that familial rejection or abuse in the home is the main reason that they've sought help from AKT. Each year we're serving more and more young people. And that's because the generic services that are set there to serve all young people are particularly failing LGBTQ. And, you know, the young people that suffer most at that are our young trans clients. And a lot of the time, our young trans clients can't access generic services. We had another young person that was asked and questioned where they were in their transition medically before they would allow them to access a female hostel. And sometimes even then when they are accessing hostels, they're asked to stay in the wrong bed, or they're asked to inhabit, you know, mixed spaces that they don't feel comfortable. So yeah, it's really important at the moment that services like Mermaids and AKT exist.
I'd say that we don't actually see very many young people who are intersectional. And I think that's because they actually have a much harder time accessing services. I don't think it's because they're not there. I think it's because they can't find it or access it, or they're in such a poor environment that to do so would actually put them at risk. About 25 to 30% of our young people that are on our youth group, which is just under 500 young people, are in an environment where they're not allowed to be themselves, and they're not allowed to talk openly about being trans, or they're not allowed to express themselves as who they are. And those are the young people that we have to keep an eye on in terms of suicidality, in terms of self-harm. And unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, one of our members, their boyfriend, who is trans and not supportive, killed himself. This shouldn't be happening now. This should not be happening now. And we just want to try and work towards making a society where parents who don't accept their children are the ones that are actually vilified, not the children themselves.
I mean, similarly, we see a really low percentage of our young trans people coming through the door that are POC, but we see like 59, 60% of our young people overall in services that access AKT identify from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds. And I think it is not because they're harder to reach, but for some reason we're harder to access. You hear lots of times services will say, oh, this is a hard to reach demographic. There's nothing hard to reach about them. You have to look inward and think, what are we doing as services that are making us difficult for them to reach out to us? And it's an ongoing conversation that we openly have at AKT about why are more of our young trans people from Black and ethnic minorities not accessing our services? Because they don't not exist. They're out there. They're just not accessing our services to the same extent that their white counterparts are. We have a lot of conversations about like how we, and you know, it is about being visible in the community. And a big part of what we've been doing at AKT over the last couple of months is literally, you know, we had a presence at Black Pride. It's going out to the nightclubs, it's going out to, you know, alcohol-free spaces, it's going out where our young people are and shouting and talking and interacting with people and talking about, you know, what we do, so that we hope that the young people that want to access their services are gonna be out there.
We asked Charlie about his experience of being a gay parent.
Listen, it's very difficult for me to say because I live in North London, central North London. My kids are at a local state school in Kentish Town where it's so unbelievably hip and liberal. I mean, there are single parents, every kind of fucking rainbow family you can imagine in my daughter's class. So they're really not unique in any way, shape or form. But I'm well aware that it's not like that. You know, we live in a bubble and that's great. And I'm very thankful for it because my kids haven't experienced any kind of bullying or even any questioning, really. You know, we're all quite involved with the school. So the kids have all grown up seeing us. So my kids don't have any of that stuff. But it does come down to education. As I say, it's not like this in other parts of the country or indeed the world. But I think children are born, or people are born, naturally accepting. You know, prejudice is learned behavior. And that's why primary education is so important. It's so important to, I want to say, get to these kids young, because I don't want to, you know, it's the same. You don't want to tell anybody what to think, but you want to educate them. And I've been into some of the schools with the AKT and also with diversity role models who deal with anti-homophobic and transphobic bullying in schools. And I've spoken to a lot of young kids and said to a bunch of 10, 11-year-old boys, what would you do if one of your male friends said that they were attracted to you? And these boys all kind of go, oh, I'd kick his fucking head in, or, you know, whatever it is. And you kind of go, okay, well, that is absolutely one way that you could deal with that situation. Or you could say, wow, I'm really flattered, thank you, but I'm not gay. And you see these kids kind of understand really quickly that that is just a really simple way of dealing with the situation. So, oh, well, I'm glad that you find me attractive, I'm not gay. And they get it very quickly. And I think just little things like that are really important to just change the dialogue, really change the conversation, because using the term gay, as I was brought up in that way as well, and it's so damaging, and you don't even realize it when you're a kid because you just say it. It's just a word that's so gay. You have to unlearn this behavior, as you were saying, and there's so much like that.
Charlie's experience of being a gay parent sounds great, and it's really lovely to hear, but surely it can't be that easy for everyone. Full disclaimer, we did try to interview an expecting lesbian couple about their journey of same-sex parenting, but their bundle of joy dropped right on the day we were due to record. This is definitely a topic we want to pick back up and properly explore in season two.
The panelists then spoke about the way trans people are portrayed in the media.
I think the media needs to take some responsibility for what they're doing. I think they need to take some accountability for the hate that they're actually stirring up, for the things that they're saying, the headlines, the anti-trans agenda against transgender women and children. Because what we see as an organization, what we see, we've got our parents groups and we've got our youth groups. And what we see is when something particularly nasty comes out, that it's then actually borne out in acts of hatred against our young people or against parents who are supporting their children.
Yeah, the media needs to fix up. The media needs to have more natural representation of our community, all facets of it, not just the white gay men that they like to see, the ones that are accepted. You see programs like Modern Family, Herald is like being like a massive, like, oh, this is great for the community. They've got like two gay dads, but okay. But they also say things that are, there's so many microaggressions even within that show itself that they don't call out. I've never seen a black queer, like black women. I've never seen a black parent, like women who have children in the mainstream media. I've not seen it. You know, I hope now that we're going to start seeing it more, but I've not seen it yet in any mainstream platform. That's a massive issue.
I find that the mainstream media's portrayal of LGBTQ people makes me feel really uncomfortable. In the past, there never seemed to be any nuance or actual research done into whatever show they were producing. Of course we want our stories to be shared, but there's no point if they won't be told in an honest way. Our community's representation in the media has improved immensely, especially with productions like Moonlight, Black Mirror's San Junipero episode, and Orange is the New Black. GLAAD's annual report from 2016 showed that overall, representation of lesbian, gay, transgender, or queer characters in Hollywood was slightly higher than in 2015. But a bleak 18.4% of the industry's top 125 films included an LGBTQ character. Gay men still make up the majority of these at 83%. Other LGBTQ plus characters were offensive, stereotypical, or didn't have a significant role. I think we should tell our own stories. We have the power of the internet and don't need to rely on being backed by massive corporations or production companies.
It's also a current debate on whether or not heterosexual and cisgendered actors should play queer and trans roles. I'm, for one, am firmly in the camp that no, they shouldn't be, for now. I am tired of our identity being used as Oscar bait by straight actors who are congratulated for daring to play gay roles. Yes, it is acting, and in an ideal world, the sexuality of the actor wouldn't be taken into consideration at casting. But that's not the reality we live in. There are many talented out actors who have spoken about the detrimental impact to their career that being honest and open about their sexuality has had. And there are many more actors who choose to remain closeted to avoid these issues. So while we don't yet have equal opportunities or representation, I think that LGBT actors should have first priority to tell our own stories. We continue the conversation and ask the panel what can be done to hold the media accountable.
I think as a community, we can be better allies for our trans brothers and sisters, right? That narrative that the media are using at the moment, right? It's they find like the most transphobic, like outspoken person they can, and they put them next to a trans person, and it's a debate. And then what that becomes is a debate about someone's identity. And this is what happened to gay men in the 1980s. Sexuality was debated as something that could be discussed. And now that's happening to our trans siblings. And I think as a community, we can be better allies in that we can call out when that's happening. And then when we watch people engage in conversations about these debates on TV, like we can call them out about what kind of like platform that that's given them and what that means to be able to debate somebody's identity like that.
Go after the money. Go after the advertisers. Point out to them that they're peddling hate, that the, you know, their adverts are put next to something that is literally just clickbait, that is actually quite astonishingly offensive. So we're working with Stop Funding Hate, and we had them along to a weekend residential, and they sat down with families and young people, and they put up some of the headlines that had been out there and the advertisers that were right next to those headlines and those really offensive pieces that essentially invalidated their children, invalidated their existence. And they talked about what that made them feel. And they put together a film, and we were going after the advertisers, because if hate doesn't pay, then maybe they'll stop doing it.
Stop Funding Hate, what Susie's referencing, is a social media campaign which aims to stop companies advertising in certain British newspapers that it argues use fear and division to sell more papers. Some media outlets post clickbait articles and everyone gets riled up about how awful it is and share it and talk about it. They're making money off that. If people stopped sharing these articles and visiting these media outlets and gave our support to stop funding hate instead, we could have power with our wallets.
I acknowledge my privilege as a cisgendered woman. So if somebody asks me, because I'm, you know, because I've got connections with XYZ, oh, we want someone to talk about the trans experience. I am not trans. Don't ask me. That happens so often, more often than I know. And then I have to be like, actually, you can talk to this person, that person, that person. You're asking the wrong person, because they think, again, the LGBT like community is all that one person represents us all. Again, I'm a black queer woman. Doesn't mean that suddenly I'm the most oppressed, because I'm not. I can walk around the street and I'm fine. Black trans women, no, she can't. And I think it's understanding that, and I think it's understanding, again, your privilege within it, and knowing that if somebody reaches out for you to speak in a panel, to do this advert, to do X, Y, Z, sometimes you have to lose out on your own money. So sometimes I've had to say that opportunity is not for me. We have to come together and understand that sometimes you do, in order to make a stand, you do have to lose out on your own coin. I'd refuse to put my name to things, to brands and to campaigns that completely invalidate the experiences of our trans brothers and sisters and siblings. Like, we can't keep on doing that, because I think people within our community do it.
I think complacency is a massive problem, actually, going back to where we started with decriminalisation. And yes, the fact is that we do live in a society now where we have equal marriage, walk down the street holding our partner's hands in a lot of places, and things are generally seen as better. But I grew up in a time when people literally fought for our rights. And I see a lot of younger people now kind of going, well, things are all right, aren't they? Things are fine. You know, we've got a good life. This is nice. We can get married. All these things are lovely. And, you know, I mean, I know it's not like that in other places in the world, but we're okay here. And I think that's part of the problem, is when there are so many countries around the world where you can still be put to death or put into prison for simply for who you choose to love or who you sleep with or whatever, who you're attracted to. But the fact is, I think it's the duty of the strong to protect the weak. And we are strong in this country, actually. We have a lot of rights that aren't afforded to people in other countries. And so it's our job to speak for those countries that can't speak and those people that can't speak. And yes, if we want to celebrate our LGBTQ plus people with an award ceremony, if we want to have yet another fucking pride, then we should do it. Because there are people around the world that can't do that stuff. And so when people say to me, do we have too many of these things? I say, no, we don't have enough of these things, actually. Because until we have equality around the world, until everyone around the world can say, yes, I'm a proud queer person and I'm able to live my life in that way, then I think it's our duty to do it. And so I think a lot of the problem is younger people today don't fight. And just remember, look at what is happening in America at the moment with women's rights. Our rights can be taken away so easily, just as easily as we've won them. And people forget that. People forget that those changes can happen so, so easily. It's terrifying. And I think that's our biggest enemy here, is people sitting back and going, well, thank God for Peter Tatchell and people like him, because we've got where we are. But actually, we're all right. We don't need to worry about that stuff so much. So I would say to anybody else thinking, what can I do? It's the small things. Go out, go and speak to Mermaids or AKT or Stonewall or Terence Higgins Trust, any of those charities. Well, what can I do? Do something. Anything, but do something. Mentor a young person, whatever it is. That's I think, where the growth is.
This is such a difficult one. 100% we need to use our protections, rights and strength to try and support the global LGBTQ movement. As we've progressed our rights in the West, there's been a counter-movement elsewhere in the globe. However, what a lot of people can forget is that when we patronise and speak down to countries and take an attitude of, oh, they're not as evolved or as civilised as us in the West, we only make the situation worse for our brethren in those places. It allows things like homosexuality to be characterised as a Western import. And when the truth of the matter is, it was actually us in the West who exported homophobia with the spread of empire and Christianity. It's a fine line to walk. We have to do something. And that should start with looking to LGBTQ groups on the ground in those places and hearing how they want our support.
To end the conversation, we asked the panel about tangible ways we can make the future of the LGBTQ community better.
Call out that casual, those microaggressions, those bits and pieces that you hear that maybe you just go, and then just walk away from. Call them out. Don't let them go unheard. Don't let them go unchallenged. The guy who said to me when my son, who is 21 now, was going off around Thailand, and he said to me, oh, you want to make sure he doesn't come back as a ladyboy? And I went, by the way, my 24-year-old daughter was assigned male at birth. Would you like to continue on that tack? And his face was an absolute picture. I wanted to take a picture of it, but still. But it's around. It's calling that out.
Definitely call people out. Call people out in your immediate circles, in your families. Like, conversations are not always meant to be comfortable. Like, I feel like the most growth happens when you do have these uncomfortable conversations with people. Like, don't just call out racism because there's a black person in the room. Call it out when you're full of, like, people that look like yourself as well. Like, you shouldn't wait. Like, if I'm around all my cisgendered friends and somebody says something transphobic, I will call it out. If they feel sad, sorry, that's your own personal business. It's not mine. You should feel bad because you're using this language. Like, unlearn it. I think we're in an age now where I've got to a point where you can't really kind of forgive some of the language that is used by people. There's the whole, oh, it's the older generation. Oh, but they're young. Oh, but no. There's literally Google.
Listen to the message that charities are out there peddling. Like, you know, we get bombarded by Just Giving pages and petitions and invites to protests on our timelines across social media all the time. But actually stop, click, read and actually pay attention, because the reason that people are going out and protesting and asking for your money and making a noise is because there is some kind of inequality that they want to try and fix, you know, or to start working towards bridging a gap. So the simple little thing you can do is to stop and to listen to the noise that people around you are making. And if you're able, then go out there and add your voice to that noise. Like, we all think that, like, oh, if I stay at home because it's raining for this protest, what's one person? But actually, it's multiple one people turning up and screaming and shouting that causes your voice to be heard. Like, that needs to be done more. And then I guess, like, things for helping charities, look how you can volunteer. Lots of charities don't ask for a lot of your time. Like at AKT, you can donate as little as 2 hours of your time a month to use your experience, your lived experience, your professional experiences, your personal experiences to mentor a young person from our community. That's all we ask, is 2 hours a month. So there are, like, little things.
Now time for audience questions.
I'm Andrew. I have a question about the line between exploitation and representation in entertainment. Someone is doing a new show, a dating show for bi people. And I know that bi people are traditionally underrepresented, but it does sound like it's just going to be something that is, you know, an excuse for good TV, as we discussed earlier. What do you guys think about that?
I think it comes down to who is the people directing it. Like, look at the team. If the team is full of straight people, then evidently it is for exploitation. But if you've got a team full of bi people and it's the show is created by somebody from the community itself, great stuff. Evidently they wanted to create it for themselves. But if it's for a team full of straight people that have no idea or have never worked with the community, then your likelihood is you are being exploited. But at the same time, in saying that, the show's still going to be out there. So there may be a bi person that sees it and be like, oh my God, there's many more of us. And that may validate their experience, but it does depend on what lens it's being used and what their agenda is.
Speaking as somebody that played a bisexual character on Coronation Street for 5 years, I find it really interesting the way that there's still so much biphobia actually out there. And when they first floated the idea of my character, who was a gay man, falling in love with a woman, you would not believe the amount of shit that I got on social media and in the press in general about how disgusting this was, that this incredibly together, out, comfortable gay man had suddenly fallen in love with a woman, and what kind of a message that was giving, and how we'd, you know, gone back 30 years and all the rest of it, and nobody would actually address the fact that this man was bisexual. He was a man that was attracted to both men and women. It's very difficult, and I think that Coronation Street actually dealt with it quite well, but perhaps not as well as they could have done. They could have come out and explained it a bit better rather than just going down there. Well, he's a gay man, but he happens to be in love with a woman. They could have explored it a bit better. But I think there's still a huge amount of work to be done with the bi community, and certainly in terms of representation.
And that concludes the live show. It was a difficult panel, really. Nobody really knew what was likely in store for us in the future. And I'm relieved that I'm not alone in not knowing that. The common theme was that while everyone was hopeful, we're also very aware that due to changing political and economic times, we could soon have another fight on our hands.
As always, I thought the panel was quite interesting. I'm glad that we were able to get the perspective of charities, because I, for one, could be donating my time to help others. What do you think is ahead, and what do you want for us?
I'm probably going to have the hell read out of me for this comment. But I think that to get the future we all want, where we do have genuine equality, I think we're all going to have to become a lot more comfortable with shades of grey and imperfect improvement. I think if we expect everything to be 100% perfect first time, and expect everybody to always know the correct answer, and either reach for pitchforks or stop engaging when someone makes a mistake, then we're only going to experience really slow progress, perhaps worse, no progress. The society that we live in isn't designed for full equality. Someone always has to be put down so the 0.1% can be on top. And so, if those of us who aren't on top fall for divide and conquer tactics, we lose. So, what I want for our future? Gay clubs and bars, not out of necessity, but out of want, out of fun. Straight allies who will respect the rules and behaviours of those places. Same goes for UK Black Pride and Trans Pride. Them all to be places of celebration and joy, rather than of necessity and survival. I would love more people to understand the concept of sexuality and gender as a spectrum, and not see it as so binary as cis, trans, gay, straight. Oh, and while I'm on my dream shopping list, let's throw in an end to slut shaming, sexual racism, and femphobia too.
I don't know what the future looks like for LGBT people. I'm not even sure the planet will still be around. Global warming is very real. I think that as our society currently works on a system where some people are simply on top and others are on the bottom, ideally, our community will be more united in the future and we'll all be on a more equal footing. I also hope that in the future, people do not assume the sexuality of a child. We're having meaningful conversations about the ever-evolving idea of sexuality and gender, and I hope those conversations continue to move forward and not backwards. Maybe in order for us to secure our future, we need to join other movements and fight for equal rights for all. Let's not forget how new all of this is. Our rights can be taken away at any point. In the words of Audre Lorde, there's no such thing as a single issue struggle, because we do not live single issue lives.
At time of recording, Trump has just announced plans to attempt to narrowly define gender as a biological, immutable state determined only by genitalia at birth. A drastic step in an attempt to roll back recognition and protection for trans people. Brazil has just elected a far-right president who is on record as saying that he would rather his child died than came out as gay. And in Tanzania, a government official has urged citizens to report homosexuals to the police. And here, in the UK, two Conservative MPs, both with a history of homophobia, lurk in the wings to potentially be our future prime ministers. While I believe that we do have a better future ahead of us, I don't think the bogeymen who would do us harm have quite given up the fight yet. We need to be vigilant, supportive, and engage with our community to look after one another.
For transcripts, full episodes, and our ever-expanding Get Involved section, go to our website, communitypod.com. You can get in touch with us on all socials at @communitypod and by using the hashtag QMMUNITYpod or by emailing us at communitypod@gmail.com.
By now, you know how podcasts work. Just search Community in your favourite app and tell all of your friends too. Give us a rating of 5 stars, and if you can, take a moment to leave us a really lovely review. It would mean a lot to us, and if you don't, 7 years of bad sex, guys.